Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are posted in the clerk's office and available for inspection. Three causes will be submitted in oral arguments this morning before the court. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Life of Beth Rose and others versus Doctors Hospital Facility, doing business as Doctors Hospital and others from Dallas County. Eagle Property Limited and others versus Clarence Sharbar Jr. and others from Midland County. And Joyce K. Evans, individually and on behalf of Amanda Jo Evans, a minor, versus Illinois Employers Insurance of Wausau from Grayson County. All three of these causes will be argued before the court breaks for lunch, but we will take a brief recess in between the submission of each cause. Counsel in the second and third causes do not have to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being argued, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we may proceed to your matter without delay in the event, unlikely event I think today, that an earlier argument finishes before its allotted time. Counsel in all causes are advised that we are recording these arguments for the convenience of the court. Should you desire to listen to these arguments, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. Court is now ready to hear oral arguments from petitioners in the matter of Rose versus Doctors Hospital.
May it please the court, Mr. James Cronzer will present argument for petitioners.
May it please the court, I hope that this morning I don't overly confuse the first and second cases which I'm supposed to argue. In this case, I really don't know where to start. Better than 2 years ago, the court granted a writ out of the Dallas court on the question of the caps in the Medical Liability Act and the economic caps I'm speaking of, and on the question of whether the Dallas court had used the proper standard in determining the verdicts in these death cases, this death case, were excessive. After that, as it was argued in January of 88, the court, however, sustained the mandamus action of the Doctors Hospital folks and sent it back to Dallas for a reconsideration of that motion. In the meantime, the court, after the arguments in Rose in January, announced its decision in Lucas versus the United States, which was a response to one of these new certified questions that the Fifth Circuit can ask this court on matters not clear to that court with respect to Texas law. There are several things about Lucas that can be said. Whatever I have to say for now in the next 5 minutes doesn't mean I'm not fully mindful that this court is composed of 7,200 pounds of gorillas. And I don't want to be lecturing on the power of this court to do anything. I have been made aware of that painfully in my past years. But I do think that these things should be said. First, obviously, from the standpoint of the Rose family, there's nothing that we can say to the court or write that we haven't written that it has not been said in our favor in the Lucas case. So it is.
You read Lucas, which involved only a common law cause of action, as being dispositive of its statutory cause.
I will get to that for this reason, Your Honor. When we were here before, Your Honor raised the question, could a distinction be made between a death case and a life injury case, and suggested, and we both did, file briefs on that subject. Now, that particular question has not been argued. It, of course, is relevant to the first point upon which you granted the writ previously. But insofar as what you said about the unconstitutionality of the Medical Liability Act and its economic caps, there isn't anything that I personally can add to what we have said or what the court said at that time. We doubt, and instead of saying you can't, since the term ended after Lucas, we doubt whether the court can re-explore that constitutional question, because you've declared the entire statute void as to that. And that's unlike changing a common law decision.
You suggest that the court cannot reconsider a prior decision?
I'm not saying that, Judge. You did that, or this court did that a year or so ago, only 4 months after a decision in which Judge Mawson disagreed with the then chief. But that's a common law decision. I'm saying when you strike a statute down as void, you can't reconsider that voidness. Now, that's why I said the same.
Any precedent for that?
When you strike a statute down and the legislature does nothing, then I'm saying to the court. That's why I started that 7,200-pound business. I don't
think... Is there any other prior decision of this 7,200 pounds that holds that?
Not of this. The Court of Criminal Appeals has held that. And if you care to have a brief on that, we'll be glad to do that.
Our mandate struck that statute down for all purposes, not merely for people similarly situated to the Lucases.
Let me say this, Your Honor, and I know I'm walking around on ice that's melting, but I want to say this. You raised this question of life death when we submitted this in January of 88.
I don't think I was the only one.
Well, okay, the court did.
Right.
And I think you turned to the court at that time and asked, would you care to have additional brief on this question? Both sides did submit briefs on the question of whether you can make a distinction between life and death. And that occurred substantially before your decision in Lucas. Now, presumably, the court had in mind those questions then, but the court smacked the whole load down. It didn't say for death or life. It said the provisions of the Act with respect to economic caps are void. And I didn't make this distinction we're talking about, so I make the argument and advance it on the court that it should not be re-explored until the legislature does something.
And you're prepared to file a brief citing this Court of Criminal Appeals?
Yes, I can give it to the clerk right now. Judge, Ex Parte Hensley, and 285 Second, 720. And it cites a number of out-of-state cases.
What does it say, Counsel?
Big question.
What does it say?
What it says is that when a court strikes down a statute, it can be amended, of course, by the legislature, which that one was. But if it's not amended, there it lies.
In other words, the court can't breathe life
back into it after it's made it. Now, I'm fully aware of the change in the composition of the court, but I felt that on behalf of the Rose family, I had to argue these things that seem in a way to challenge the court's jurisdiction, not power. Believe me, I'm not challenging power. But I want to just say that as far as Lucas is concerned, we have submitted since its decision numerous lengthy cases from other jurisdictions, in bank, full courts in those states, several of which have cited your decision and all of which have struck down economic caps in similar legislation unless there has been a quid pro quo to the people affected, which is, as I say, I'm exhausted on what else we can say. I want to say that in answer to the Chief Justice and Justice Heck's questions, that we did brief, but have not argued, the question of life and death. It is our view with respect to that Article 26, Section 48 of the Constitution of 1876 expressly made the Wrongful Death Acts or similar legislation and the then existing common law, the common law of Texas from 1876 on.
And I assume it follows from that position that the legislature could not abolish a cause of action for wrongful death by repealing the Wrongful Death Act.
I'm not going to say that, Judge. The reason I say that, if you read Middleton by Texas Fire and Light, the one determining the validity of the Compensation Act back in 1916, the court, after concluding there were quid pro quos for every exchange of rights gained or lost, concluded the legislature has power to provide no causes of action as such. But when you mess and tamper with the cause of action is what we're talking about in this case. And that's what you said, or what the court said in Lucas, and holding that it contravened Article 1, Section 13, and incidentally the trial by jury, Article 1, Section 15. And as I say,
but your view of it is simply that the legislature cannot, without more, simply repeal the Wrongful Death Act. I mean, if it just abolished the cause of action without some quid pro quo, constitutionally infirm.
No, I think it can abolish the workers' compensation and the common law itself. The only question is as to existing people who have their rights at the time of that abolition, they can't abolish those. But going a step further, and I may have started this too negatively, I really believe, as you would well know, that Lucas is well decided and properly decided. I'm not saying the legislature can't do something about it. I'm merely saying that it is right. We can't take any other, so we believe in it. But now the life-death thing, this court has recognized that the Death Act passed in 1860 is a protected right under the organic law. The legislature in LRB, which the court is true, it's an NRE case, but it deals with this 10-year statute that exonerates contractors, architects, and those people, have held that statute is constitutional as to certain aspects, but not as to others. It, at the time being what it is, it would be difficult for me to argue all the reasons why, first, I don't think the court can or should distinguish between life or death cases. It was an existing cause of action adopted by the Constitution of 1876, and to tamper with it on the theory it can go down or be modified or the amounts changed, but not true of an injury case, is to even more clearly focus on the matter spoken to in Lucas. That is, the people most seriously damaged or most seriously hurt by a non quid pro quo statute, which this one is.
Well, now, let me be sure I understand it, Mr. Conger. Because you say the Wrongful Death Act was passed prior to the Constitution and the Constitution adopted it, is it now your position that the legislature cannot abolish or repeal the Wrongful Death Act?
Judge, I don't say the legislature can't repeal every known cause of action that we had prior to 1876. And in fact, I think that's the way to read Middleton. There's no guarantee that there is that much rigidity in the common law causes of action or in the wrongful death in Sanchez versus Schindler. You openly said, we repeal these statutes to get to the new intangible death benefit.
Well, if they can repeal it, why can't they limit it?
Well, the reason is, as to people that are hurt or injured, they can't limit it disproportionately. See, that's what the holding is in Lucas. You can't leave causes of action extant and distinguished because of the equal protection and the due process and due course of the land cases. If the causes of action is going to exist, you can't distinguish it.
Isn't the holding of Lucas that the only protection afforded by the open courts provision protection for well-recognized or well-defined common law causes of action?
No. The holding is it violates Article 1, Section 13, giving access to the courts. Let me make it clear, Judge Zargit. There was never any suggestion in that case or in this case that such a distinction could be made. You also dealt with Article 1, Section 15, the trial by jury provision in Lucas. But
we're getting down some rabbit hole, but could you give me a... Never mind. I just don't recall that being in the opinion, but... There was a footnote that dealt with Article 3, Section 52.
I'm talking about the right of trial by jury.
No, I don't think there's any majority opinion. But anyway, that's a rabbit trail,
and
almost every time we've got, it may take that long to recite the facts in 1 minute or so.
I don't want to leave the court. I think it's ending up on that subject. I think it would mislead the Fifth Circuit to now tell them we only meant this to apply to injury actions, when you have told them the act is unconstitutional in this respect. But again, I know the dangerous ground I'm trodden on to talk about what the court's power is. But I would also, in conclusion of those remarks, ask the court once again examine the decisions of other states since dealing with this very question, applying it to life and death situation. The Sophie case, an in-bank case for a cyber board, dealt specifically with this so-called distinction between old causes of action and new causes of action, rejected it. All of the courts of civil appeals that have dealt with this death act, because it itself provides applicability to death and injury. Oh, that's what it applies to. Have nothing to say. And finally, it seems to me on a pure waiver basis, this question was never raised by the defendant, respondents here, until this court mentioned it during the oral arguments in 1988. And that's too late to raise a constitutional question like that.
Is there any way to hold these caps violative of the open courts provision without in a cause of action based upon a statute rather than the common law without overruling Sachs versus Voter?
I don't think you have to overrule Sachs versus Voter just because it said it named the two prongs of the test. That was not mutually exclusive as to say to the question we're talking about at all in that case. And I don't think Sachs, the only thing that's predicatory language, but it doesn't require any overruling to reach the question that this applies to both death and life, and one goes or the other goes.
Before you leave this to go on, just tell us how you would write it if you were writing.
I would write it just like Lucas, and because the point's been raised, say that this of course applies.
Well, how under Sachs and under Lucas do you to find protection, whatever might be the many grounds, and as you well know, there have been many varied grounds in the decisions from other states for invalidating these kind of caps. But under our provision on open courts, how do you find protection under the open courts provision for a cause of action that is statutory in nature rather than common law if wrongful death is purely a statutory cause of action, which it may not be?
In Ellerby, that court said it is a negligence action, and it is. But we never did enshrine and place in concrete the English common law on any cause of action. And that, of course, seems to be what it's the root of this. Judge, I criticize the Fifth Circuit. You were handed a certified question that dealt only with under state law. The court had made its decision that the Texas Act met the requirements of federal due process and the 14th Amendment. And now all we want to know, how does it do under your act? That's what Lucas is. And I'm telling the court, I think the Court of Appeals, Judge Higginbotham, was wrong in that regard. These cases that we see from other jurisdictions go straight to the heightened scrutiny test where there is no quid pro quo, and I'm talking about federal due process. So to answer your question, you're not, of course, bound by those limits of what you said. You could add the other grounds of the federal constitutional grounds. In my opinion, the right of trial by jury is a right that is also transgressed by this, not to give people their equal protection when you're given a right of trial by jury.
Why is that?
Because I think that you have protected the right. If you're saying the right of trial by jury can be preserved with respect to a cause of action depending on its quantum, and you're only going to guarantee they get some kind of a little trial, then I think that maybe you can make that distinction as far as trial by jury is concerned. But if the foundation of our argument is the fact that this state in 1876 expressly adopted all of the laws outstanding in Texas as a part of that Constitution, and construing the Constitution as a whole, which we believe is not, that then the Act applies to statutory causes that were then existent, as well as the common law, because they're all in the nature of negligence actions.
Doesn't it follow from that argument, Mr. Cronger, that the only way to amend, abolish, or in any other way affect causes of action existing prior to the 1876 Constitution is to amend the Constitution?
So long as those are uniformly and equally denied everybody, you can, in my opinion, emasculate the right that existed either at common law or otherwise prior to 1876. The legislature can. I don't guess you all theoretically can or should, but because of the development of the common law. But I'm merely saying that unless it's some striking down so that everybody is equally affected, I don't think you can do it as to people and still leave causes of action outstanding for the big cases and the little cases and that sort of thing.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Tell us what you'd like to say about the remitted judgment.
Well, that's what I've always been trying to get to that.
That's why it's the question.
I say, Your Honor, on that question, that Texas, of course, has never held that you can't preserve or say you're not going to waive your right to test the correct standard for reaching sufficiency questions. If there's anything that's clear, that this court has now posited and put aside the idea there's a difference between the sufficiency test applicable to one type of case and applicable to damages, as late as Sosa versus City of Branch, with this court repeated the rule. If you apply the wrong damage rule in the state courts of appeals, this court has jurisdiction to correct them. That's exactly what you've been dealing with in all these Coker and all these other cases, and what you've announced now on three distinct occasions. Now, if the Court of Appeals is correct that a failure to just file your remittiture with nothing more, then you've lost your right to test that because there's no vehicle to get it before this court. You have to have that contention in your motion for rehearing in the Court of Civil Appeals as a Court of Appeals as a condition to this court hearing. And if you read their opinion and read the other side's brief, it's clear what they're saying. Texas is like Pennsylvania and these other states, that you have got to lay down and play dead and can't question how the court got to it.
You can question it, can't you? You just can't, if you lose, you just can't then accept the Court of Appeals remittiture.
That means you get a new trial, Judge.
Yeah.
And suppose that we could all agree that the Court of Appeals has used an improper standard in reaching the question of damages. And we assume that for argument purposes. And the Court of Appeals, and you say, well, Judge, we want to at least protect by motion rehearing in some way that right to question the legal way you reach. If that suggestion you just made, and I know it's rhetorical, it's not a decision question, but if that is correct, there's no way the party affected by that can later test it except by falling down and laying dead. Now, you can't get that out of the rules. You can't get that out of Rule 85C at all. You can't get it out of the cases. The annotation dealing with the cases the Court of Appeals used and that they used clearly places Texas as a case where you can question. Now, the main case they cite, Texas City Bank, Cross El Paso Bank, or something, I believe that's the name of it, holds exactly contrary to what the Court of Appeals says and they say. In that case, the party affected by the remittiture filed the remittiture under protest. And the trial court entered the judgment as remitted, even with that protest. The Court of Appeals struck the whole thing back, said it should be dismissed, the case on appeal, sent back, because they had done that under protest. This court said there's no basis to protest unless the other side appeals, but it was a good remittiture. And the court should, the trial court was correct in letting the case go to, and reviving the judgment accordingly. It did not hold that it was ineffective for purposes of filing the remittiture. The bottom line on this question is that a party in damages matters will be denied any access to this court on a remittiture, when this court has for years treated that question as a matter within its jurisdiction, when it involves a legal standard. We have never contended, and do not now, that factually that this court has any power over it, but only that you can determine whether the proper standard was used. And if Sosa decided last year in 89, in July, by this court, is correct, that power to correct that will be taken away, and even more importantly, it will make the fact unfinding powers of the courts of the people absolute as fact finding powers. And you have struggled with that for years, and since Poole have made it abundantly clear where you stand. And I honestly believe you.
If the Court of Appeals holds that the damages were excessive, you can certainly appeal that.
Not to here.
Why not?
Because it has exclusive fact-finding power over excessiveness.
As to whether the standard was...
And we did, and you granted that writ 2 years ago on that point.
And if you lose, then what is the effect of that?
Then if you lose, if we lose, and you don't order under in Petco in those cases for them to let the amendment and forget that, or just say that the court has already determined it's excessive, so the verdict stands as they revised it and reformed it in the Court of Appeals with the money cut off, which is what the Supreme Court did.
Have you asked for the right to, at any point in this? At any point in your briefing or in motions, have you asked for the right to supplement your request to the Court of Appeals to make some different type of amendment?
Well, Judge, when that question was raised,
I mean, I'll just ask that because you just mentioned it.
We asked that they permit us, if that's what they were going to say, to revise our remittiture under the Rule 83, Trap Rule 83, and the holdings of this court in the holding in Petco versus International Bank, where you said you can't reverse a case for form errors. And they didn't do that, and the court knows what happened after we kind of prodded them up there when I'm over and up.
Was this a form error or a conscious decision?
It was a conscious decision, Judge, for us to try to preserve a right to complain to this court they had not used the correct standard.
Under your interpretation of remittiture, isn't it kind of a hazard take and eat it too?
You can't revise the... If you determine, for example, in this case, that the court used the wrong standard, then you have to send it back to that Court of Appeals for a determination under the correct standards. But you can't yourself determine it's too big or too little.
Does remittiture in that case just serve to set a floor?
Well, what you're confronted with in this situation, Judge, if they cut the verdict and the award, that if you can't assign error in your motion for rehearing or somewhere below, or say you're not just waving up that right to test the standards, then you can't test it in this court at all. In Pope versus Moore, the leading case, this exact procedure was followed from the Waco court. And you reviewed it and set standards for review. I'll close with this thought. I have no right to and do not question the power of this court to do what it says it thinks is right at any given time. But I do believe it would be sad indeed to back off of Lucas, to make a distinction between life or death, or to say that undertaking to preserve your right to complain in this court of a legal error, and you may conclude it isn't one, is that those are well taken positions. Thank you for spending my time long enough for me to finish my thoughts.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Ellison, will present arguments from respondents.
May it please the court. 2 years ago, almost to the date in this case, questions were first posed on the original presentation of petitioners by Justice Kilgarlic about this distinction involving common law causes of action. And indeed, I spent the bulk of my time in response dealing with that issue, with cases and authorities on that issue. In rebuttal, petitioner's counsel avoided the issue, didn't say anything about it, and was asked by this court and told by this court, this is a distinction that this court is interested in. Do you have any authorities on the point? Well, first he began to read the Court of Appeals opinion, and in the midst of it, to his horror, he figured out that it didn't have anything to do with this case. It didn't have anything to do with the distinction. Indeed, the court dropped over it because it didn't have to address the issue because it found the statute constitutional anyway, even under the appropriate test. So then we get back to the point of asking for the right to submit a supplemental brief. And in that supplemental brief, still no authority. Today, still no authority. Indeed, the petitioners take the position that Lucas is almost a chameleon. On the one hand, they argue, well, Lucas really did involve this issue because it struck down the whole statute.
Assuming that the capping of damages that are done in the statute, it violates the open courts provision with respect to common law causes of action, and that Lucas is correctly decided, assuming that, then isn't there a severe equal protection problem with not having the same holding with respect to statutory cause of action?
Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand the question, because the fact of the matter is a statutory cause of action exists as a result and by grace of the legislature. And that's the very logic behind the distinction between these common law causes of action and the way that legislative acts are treated. I'm not sure the equal protection argument fits in that context. I mean, the fact is that what this court has held, in fact, what this court held in Lucas, and let's remember when Lucas was decided, this case had already been argued. The supplemental briefs on this issue had already been submitted. This court was well aware of this issue on the common law distinction. Yet what it did in Lucas was specifically reiterate the test set forth in Sachs, which was set forth in LeBone, which was discussed in Middleton, and which follows a long line of Texas authorities that say repeatedly, decisions by this court, that a common law cause of action, it must be established that there was a common law cause of action involved. That's what open courts was intended to apply to. And if the Constitution chooses to protect one type of cause of action and not another, statutory cause of action, that's not an equal protection clause. That is expressed sanction by the Constitution of the very thing that is being done. And again, that's not an act of the legislature in that circumstance. That's an act of the people of the state of Texas in their Constitution.
So you think there's no equal protection problem with the legislature deciding that it was not going to cap common law causes of action, but was going to cap wrongful death causes of action?
No, I don't believe there is, Your Honor. They had the right to do that. You do get to the point, though. I mean, that one thing, let us make clear, we are not saying that the legislature is totally free to do anything it wishes. It is the Constitution that mandates that particular result. It allows that result because it's not a common law cause of action. It allows that result. But we have an argument here, really, that goes across the board. Lucas addresses the issue, they say. And then, on the other hand, they say Lucas doesn't address the issue. Well, in fact, if it's going to fall on one side or the other, Lucas could not rule on an issue that wasn't before them. They couldn't strike down this statute for all purposes as to statutory causes of action if that was not an issue before them. The court only decides the constitutional questions presented, and the certification process does not it's not sufficiently broad to let you just come in and do anything. You're presented with a set of facts, you're presented with a designated issue, and that was not presented in Lucas. Lucas still states the test, adds to the long line of cases in Texas continuing to say common law cause of action must be involved for open courts to apply.
Well, I think you set out correctly the reasoning of Lucas, but when you get down to the holding, it declared subsections 1102 and 1103 inconsistent with Article 1, Section 13. So you think they remain, despite that holding, they remain valid for death cases only?
Yes, that is correct. Because the court states on the very, I believe it's the third page of the opinion, it expressly states that it must be established that there was a common law cause of action infringed.
Is there anything in Lucas that says that it applies, that it's undeclaring the sections unconstitutional only if you're alive?
Your Honor, that was the only issue put before the court. The facts that were sent from the Fifth Circuit expressly stated that the case was not a death case.
The statute itself doesn't seem to draw a distinction, does it? The 1102, 1103, or what you're talking about in the definition of a health liability claim includes both personal injury and death.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Why draw a distinction?
Because the Constitution permits the distinction. Because
we have
the
to say the statute that the legislature didn't. There may be some kind of savings clause within the whole act.
Yes, there is indeed a savings clause. Well, there is in that act.
Why and doesn't it, the, to deal with a little different aspect of this, why doesn't the reference in another section of the Constitution to exemplary damage claims for wrongful death action, why doesn't that give a wrongful death action a certain kind of constitutional protection?
I believe the exemplary damage provision exists in the Constitution independent of that wrongful death cause of action. It is just a consequence of an independent provision. There's nothing about that provision that would give some imprimatur that this is somehow a common law or organic cause of action.
Well, the Constitution recognizes a cause of action for wrongful death and specifically provides that exemplary damages may be awarded in certain circumstances where there's wrongful death. Can the legislature come in and repeal that right?
Well, they couldn't repeal a provision that was expressly against the Constitution. And again, the punitive damages provision has its own separate constitutional protection. So in that instance, you're not looking at open courts. And that's what I was saying, is that you're not saying the legislature has, you know, free grace to do anything it wishes. It's just that the open courts provision cannot be the provision that is used to find it unconstitutional.
You would have to look at the open courts provision, the same question that your opposing counsel was asked. Do you think under the open courts provision the legislature can repeal the wrongful death act?
Your Honor, I believe in the Middleton decision, as well as in repeated decisions after the Middleton decision, this Court has said the legislature has the power to abolish or to modify a cause of action. And that is even more true with respect to open courts analysis, where you're talking about a statutorily created cause of action.
But there must be a quid pro quo. Haven't we said that?
No. The first test of Sachs versus Butler and of Lucas versus the United States is that the plaintiff petitioner trying to rely on unconstitutionality established that a well-established, well-defined common law cause of action is involved. You don't even get to the quid pro quo, the balancing test. You get to none of that unless you meet the first test. And it is not satisfied in this case. Long line of Texas cases, Supreme Court cases saying it has to be a well-established common law cause of action.
Is there any open courts case in Texas that involves the abolition or change of a statutorily created cause of action?
Yeah, well, I believe there's one Court of Appeals opinion, Your Honor, and that would be Stout versus Grand Prairie, 733 Southwest 2nd, 290. And there the Court was dealing with the abolition of the right to sue a school teacher for injuries caused by negligence. Indeed, an essential part of the Court's analysis in that case in dealing with whether or not the school district itself, which also was a beneficiary of this the Court specifically dealt with on pages 296 and 297 the question of whether or not there was a common law cause of action. And of course, the Court correctly noted that sovereign immunity barred at common law this type of suit. Thus, the abrogation could not involve open courts protection because of that fact. In addition, Your Honors, the specific issue of counsel has repeatedly inundated this Court as well as the Court of Appeals with all of the cases from other jurisdictions. It's almost a biweekly affair. Unfortunately, he has not presented to this Court by letter the other cases, because there are plenty of other cases. In fact, there's one that was relied on in Lucas, which has been overturned, the Lala. The Fourth Circuit has rejected it. There's been a Third Circuit decision that has rejected the approach. Indeed, if you look at the last six cases decided, five of them are going against the trend that they try to create. Sophie versus Fiber Board expressly states, and that's the one that they relied on, is addressing this common law distinction in other jurisdictions. Indeed, the Sophie Court specifically states the reason for this decision is the right to trial by jury. It doesn't have anything to do with open court. So we've cited all of these cases. What about Texas? Does Texas have a case that presents the issue here? And that is the common law cause of action distinction in wrongful death. And indeed, the Corpus Court of Appeals has addressed that issue in a case called Castillo versus Hidalgo. The Court will give me just a moment. I'll get that cite for the Court. That is 771 Southwest 2nd, 633. And I think this court really addresses this sort of organic law argument that's being made by Mr. Cronzer. Their siblings were attempting to challenge the constitutionality of the Wrongful Death Act itself because it discriminated. It said that siblings could not sue under the Wrongful Death Act. And the court said we cannot apply open court's analysis in that situation because there is no, the cause of action for wrongful death is a purely statutory cause of action.
But you can apply equal protection in that is in the case of illegitimate children.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. And again, that's the point. We're not opening the door completely for the legislature. It's just that this open courts provision will not help.
So coming back to my question, having created a cause of action for wrongful death by statute, and there being a common law cause of action for personal injury, can the legislature cap one and not the other without transgressing equal protection?
I believe the legislature cannot be ascribed the intent to cap one and not the other. They attempted to cap both.
But since the court had, assuming the court has correctly decided in Lucas that they can't cap the one, can they then cap the other?
Well, Your Honor, I believe they can, because what they were trying to achieve was to try to put some type of cap on the most egregious types of cases. And, of course, there are two really egregious types of cases that can be involved here. One is the case involving a paraplegic, quadriplegic, where there are lots of medicals that are going to be involved. That type of case, it does not improperly discriminate. A rational basis exists for it because of the fact that under the statute, you're able to get all of the medical. That's the big problem in that type of case.
Could they cap the damages recoverable by a spouse, but not cap the damages recoverable by a child or a parent?
Well, I'm not sure what the basis would be for the legislature trying to do that.
They're just trying to hold down the recovery.
Well, I think that one of the legislative purposes is, at least in creating a wrongful death cause of action, and making the discrimination between who gets to recover and who doesn't, is they wanted to derive what were the closest relationships. Those are the things that should be compensated. That was the discrimination they were trying to achieve in giving a right that did not otherwise exist. I think in giving a right, that certainly would not involve any type of equal protection problem.
Without trying to discern exactly what they were after, my question to you, though, is could they cap the damages recoverable by one group of beneficiaries under the Wrongful Death Act, but not those recoverable by another group, without transgressing equal protection?
At least here on the spot, Your Honor, I cannot think of a reason for why they would want to do that, except perhaps, as to some, for instance, spouses, they might be bigger claims, which again impact upon insurance rates, which impact upon the cost of the insurance and impact upon the medical costs involved in the availability of medical care. That would be one potential basis for making that type of discrimination.
If the ball were back in the legislature's court and they were reading Lucas, you suggest that they might still decide to cap wrongful death causes of action because those are the more egregious action? Was that your...
No, Your Honor, I believe that they have already done that. The statute is on the books, and the only question before this court is whether or not the open courts provision is violated as a result of the statute itself, and we cannot get to open course analysis here because it is not a well-established common law cause of action.
No, but we can get to equal protection and due process.
That is correct, Your Honor, and again, under equal protection, we're dealing with a rational basis test. I believe this, as has been discussed at length in a number of the dissenting opinions as well as in the briefs before this court on that issue that wasn't addressed in Lucas, that there is, in fact, a rational basis for what the legislature did in this case. You're trying to achieve a societal good, and I think that's perhaps where we get to the problem with Lucas, is that it totally disregards consideration for the interests of society. We have, in effect, made the quid pro quo, the individual quid pro quo, which is now required in every case, supposedly after Lucas. In doing that, we have violated Middleton, which said that we cannot exalt the common law to the point that it becomes a constitutional right, and we put the interest, and let's just think about on medical malpractice, what types of, and what numbers and what percentages of society that we have there. Small percentage of society has medical malpractice claims. Even smaller still, the ones that are affected by this act. What we have done in Lucas by cutting out the societal quid pro quo is that we have exalted the right to those lawsuits so high for that small percentage of society that all of society, no matter how loud they cry, no matter how hard they want available medical care at lower cost, no matter, or take it to another situation, whatever society needs and wants is to be disregarded. For example, in the Stout case, the court wanted to make sure that we had teachers. They wanted to, very similarly to this act, they wanted to reduce the insurance premiums by abrogating this particular type of cause of action in one instance, limiting it in another. And again, under those facts and circumstances, the court is just trying to achieve some societal interest and benefit. They note in the Stout decision, they specifically state, it's to the benefit of the state, to the benefit of the people as a whole, to be able to have teachers. And we're going to encourage teachers here. But that societal interest in the Stout case, under this mandatory quid pro quo analysis, is gone. There are other examples that can be thought about. For example, the blood transfusion statute, which eliminates totally a product's liability cause of action against blood banks. The defense of that statute is it's good for society as a whole. It is in the interest of society as a whole to be able to have blood banks not subject to suit for strict liability, the easy road to recover. But again, that consideration is gone under the analysis in Lucas that is presented with this mandatory quid pro quo. What petitioner is arguing in this case, again, is that on this common law distinction, that on the one hand Lucas addresses it, but on the other it doesn't. And indeed, Lucas certainly states and restates the test, and we believe that test is still applicable in this case. Indeed, the attempt to argue that Lucas goes beyond that, it goes beyond it, and you just kick this statute out for good. Of course, this ex parte Hensley has never been cited. It took 2 years to get to that case, and we've not had that case cited to us. It's not been presented in a brief. And I dare say that it violates virtually every rule that is imaginable as far as proper constitutional interpretation. The court decides the issue that's before it. Nothing more, nothing less. That issue was not before the court.
We've got, under that theory, maybe the constitutional provision for these advisory opinions is unconstitutional because we didn't dispose of any. We had no control issue. Mandate
is to
litigate
in this. I think that is a serious question that exists with respect to that certification procedure. I'm not sure what the ramifications are about the way the thing was approved and what sanctity it gets from the way it was approved and added to our laws.
About 80% of the vote for the people.
Yeah.
Gather they wanted it. But are you trying to put in our minds any doubt that our judgment in Lucas was effective at least to do? Are you saying it was ineffective to declare common law causes of action unconstitutional under the Open Courts Act insofar as that they were capped by the legislature in this particular statute?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's exactly right. And indeed, even if the court had the opportunity to address that issue, it's done in the opinion. If we assume that the court had that power, the court specifically states in Lucas, first, the petitioner, and quoting exactly from Sack, the petitioner must establish that the right infringed is a well-established common law cause of action.
And again, had this ex parte handle the case raised until this morning?
That is the first time that case has been raised.
Respond with some supplemental brief on that issue?
Yes, Your Honor, I would welcome the challenge to get to respond to the Hensley case. Because again, let's look at Sanchez versus Schindler. I think that's a good example and a good immediate response to that problem. Because Sanchez, I mean, you know, for years and years and years, the court interpreted the statute in one way, pecuniary loss, and that's all you get. And then all of a sudden, they decided to change that interpretation. And they're interpreting a statute there. There's no mistake about that. There would have been an even bigger brouhaha about the Sanchez opinion had it tried to develop some type of common law rule. Sanchez says we have the right to be able to change our interpretation. How does that fit into this circumstance? How can that case sit on the same page with this interpretation of the Hensley decision? Guest statute. Guest statute was held constitutional. Once you've decided it, it's constitutional under this Hensley rule. Doesn't the flip side work? Once you've decided it's constitutional, can you ever hold it's unconstitutional? That brings into question Whitcomb versus Bynum.
Well, there is some difference. If this court holds the statute constitutional and it continues to be applied and relied on it, we'll hold it unconstitutional.
he is not relied upon. Trial judge, litigants don't, litigants plead in a certain way, insurance companies respond in a certain way, defenses are not raised, trial judges do not limit judgments when they're coming out. I don't believe we can resurrect a statute that's been declared unconstitutional. And the narrow question presented is, I guess too, what, do we have a mandate in these county cases that are certified? And if we do, you know, what was this one? And if it did in fact propose to declare this entire CAPS unconstitutional as to both common law and statutory causes of action. Did we have the authority to do that? And if we did, then and did do it, was that, is that mooted? And if not mooted, then we get to the merits of it. You know, is there a distinction between statute and common law?
Again, even if the court had the authority.
But I can't believe that you would say that, because I think I heard you arguing there a few minutes ago, that we could come back and dig a statute up that we declared unconstitutional and all of a sudden say this statute was constitutional after all, it's enforced. Go back and reorder your lives.
Well, Your Honor, that's part of the debate that is going on right now on the issue of abortion, as to whether or not the interpretation of the United States Constitution can in fact be changed. And indeed, just like any law...
Is anybody saying that it would resurrect? Are people saying that if Roe versus Wade is overruled, that resurrects the Texas statute as it existed in 1973 and then it's immediately back on the books?
Well, if the statute was not otherwise repealed. Because again, the plaintiff has to come into the case, or the petitioner, or whoever's relying on unconstitutionality, get a little dry after standing up here for a while, they have to prove that it applies to their case. Otherwise, we wind up just giving all sorts of advisory opinions in any constitutional case. Because how could this court in Lucas decide a constitutional issue without the issue being before them on facts? And indeed, how can it even be implied that Lucas holds to the contrary on behalf of the litigants involved in this case when the court states the rule upon the very rule upon which we rely is still in place? Now, just to go on and address a couple of other items that Mr. Cronzer has raised with respect to the open courts issue, he keeps talking about Article 16, Section 48. I think it's clear in the briefs, but I just want to make one point about that. The commentary to that statute in the clear language of that particular provision states that the laws under the old Constitution are valid under the new Constitution. There is not one word, one sentence, one phrase that in any way hints that suddenly black is white, that suddenly legislative-made law is judge-made law. That's just not there. Then we get to the second part of what they try to argue to meet this common law test. This organic law argument, interesting concatenation of different opinions and texture sites. We get a cite to texture that says Constitution is the organic law. Then they cite the Nelson decision, which says wrongful death is organic law. They connect those two with an interesting syllogism, which comes out with the result, well, if Constitution is organic law, if the Wrongful Death Act is organic law, therefore the Wrongful Death Act is a constitutional right. Well, of course, that's wrong, and indeed it ignores the very language which the court in Nelson used. They didn't cite the language, the sentence that immediately preceded that, which says the wrongful death cause of action is wholly statutory. Third thing that they rely upon in their opinion is this common elements argument from the Ellerbe case. And indeed, the Ellerbe case skips that test. They skip the test of common law cause of action because they go ahead and hold that the statute is constitutional. And what is cited in petitioner's brief is the rule in that case is that, quote, wrongful death is a negligence cause of action, period, close quote. Indeed, what the case says, and they don't even reflect the ellipsis to show the omissions, is since wrongful death is a negligence cause of action, comma, as asserted by plaintiffs, comma, and then they go on to set the test in the case. Doesn't even say what they say. And all the argument is that they're making on Ellerbe is that because the elements to prove a wrongful act under the wrongful death statute are the same as negligence, somehow judge-made law, or rather statutory-made law, legislative-made law, becomes judge-made law. That argument is fallacious. And again, it's been rejected by the Texas courts. Other states. We've heard a lot about other states in this case. You can line them up every direction, and I think at this point in time, they're pretty even, depending on what brand you want to take and how you want to divide them up. But one thing is clear, and I think that's true in the briefs, and it hasn't been questioned by petitioners, Every case that has addressed the issue that is involved in this case, whether a wrongful death act survives scrutiny under this type of common law cause of action requirement, has held in favor of the petition of the position of the respondents in this case. Indeed, Alabama, good example. Slagle versus Parker. The court noted that a prior case, the Alabama Court of Appeals, or the Alabama Supreme Court, had held that the fellow employee immunity doctrine in a non-death case violated the open court's provision. This is just like the Lucas situation where you're trying to say unconstitutional once, unconstitutional forever. Held it unconstitutional in that situation. No discussion of the common law cause of action distinction. You come down to Slagle versus Parker, same issue. Constitutionality of the fellow employee doctrine. The court says, now wait a minute, this is a wrongful death action, fellas. This is not a common law cause of action. The statute and the immunity is not unconstitutional. I think that's exactly the kind of situation we have presented in this case.
There has been you to the remediature point, your remaining time, why shouldn't the petitioner get his cake and eat it too?
Well, to do that, Your Honor, we would have to completely emasculate the purpose of remediature. And one thing, really, really important point, is that, you know, you get the question, and I think it has got to run through your mind quite a bit, how can a court designate a specific amount? How can they just go up there and pick an amount and make it stick? The key is consent. The key is consent, because without the consent of the petition, the designation of that amount, without that consent, it is a substitution of their judgment for that of the jury.
But the Court of Appeals is not negotiating with the party, surely. Surely the Court of Appeals is determining the judgment that should have been rendered and is asking the party to accept that judgment or consent to a new trial or to have a new trial.
Well, Your Honor,
not just picking a number out to say, how about if we just cut this out and you take X thousand dollars?
Certainly I wouldn't want to imply they're trying to seek an incorrect number. They're trying to reflect a number they think is correct.
But if they think that's correct, then why shouldn't the petitioner and the higher court get to accept that number in the event that he's wrong about the standard that was applied?
Well, because the purpose of remediature, and that's where we have to look to see how it applies in this situation, the purpose of remediature is a form of let's make a deal. It is an offer by the court to bring litigation to an end. It is an offer by the court. They're saying, plaintiffs, we're making you an offer. You can either take what we think is a fair and reasonable amount based on the evidence, or you can take a new trial.
My question is that really what's going on, or is the Court of Appeals really saying, this is what should have been done, but we can't order it under the law, all we can do is say, take it or take a new trial?
Practically, Your Honor, I think they're saying this is what we think is fair under the law. Legally, and I think the cases cited in the brief discuss this repeatedly and establish it, the purpose of it is to make a deal. It is an offer, and in this case, we had a counteroffer.
If the judgment were for $1 million, and the Court of Appeals said, well, we think that only $500,000 was warranted on this record, but we don't think that the party is going to give up further appeal for a mere $500,000, so we suggest a remediature of only $300,000 and hope that he'll take that and give up his appeal. If there were an appeal of that, we would say that that's all right. That's within the province of the Court of Appeals to offer.
Your Honor, there's no guideline as to how they pick that amount. And again, it is an offer, counteroffer situation.
I agree with your analysis, I think, that the purpose of remediature is to try to bring litigation to an end. But accepting that, why should we get in a situation where if a party believes that the appellate court has applied the wrong standard in doing that, they're put to the hogs of choice of giving up what they think they're entitled to, or are going through the interminable delay of new discovery, new trial, and a new appellate process? Why, if the purpose of it is to get litigation to an end, shouldn't this court have the power to review whether or not the proper standard was applied, not substitute our own judgment?
Well, Your Honor, their choice, I mean, if you do not give effect to that choice, if you don't enforce that choice and make them stick to it when they make them, why make the offer? Again, it defeats the purpose to bring litigation to the end to say that they can then appeal it.
Well, but it's not an offer from you. It's a decision by the court.
That is correct, which I think is at least conceptually is understood the best understood as a form of offer to them. You take your poison as the remedy. Either you get to appeal, in which case the remedy is a motion, is a new trial, which is a typical remedy on a factual insufficiency point. Or you choose to accept the remittiture, you
well,
stick to it.
The insufficiency point is done in part with the standards that are appropriate in the law.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Isn't that what we're talking about here?
Well,
this court is powerless to set any standards?
The court is not. The court is made powerless in this case by the choice that is made by the plaintiffs with respect to the remittiture. They are on the horns of a dilemma in this case. On the one hand, if they consent to the remittiture and they accept it, it is an acquiescence in the judgment. That's what the case law says. You cannot acquiesce in the judgment and then appeal it. It's at an end. I mean, that's the whole purpose. It is a meaningless rule if you do not bring it to an end. If they want to appeal it, if they want to attack that standard, then they say, no, we are not going to accept the remittiture, and they are not then entitled to the benefits of that remittiture because they haven't accepted it. It's purposeless to do it otherwise.
But so then they get a motion for new trial granted, and they can't appeal that either.
Well, they can appeal it, Your Honor, and that is the perplexing thing about the prohibition in this case, which we have had no clue as to what the court's problem was with the way the case was progressing. Because if they want to take the position that they have not in fact consented to the judgment, then the only thing changed by the Court of Appeals' opinion is that the remedy for the factual insufficient finding is set in stone. It is a new trial. That choice has been made. But then they can take it. They could have more. They had their second motion for rehearing on file. It could have been considered by the Court of Appeals, ruled upon. They file an application for writ of error with this court, bring the issue on the standard and the excessiveness before this court. There was nothing barring them from doing that. Nothing barring them whatsoever. The only problem was, if they truly did consent to the remittitures, then yes, they are barred from doing that. But they had the choice of being able to avoid all of those problems. And again, we're still not sure exactly what position they're taking in this case. They say, well, we did consent to it. No, we didn't. I mean, we're trying to straddle a line here. There has to be a decision, because if it was a consent, no appeal. If there was not a consent, the remedy is set in stone. If I may just sum up on a couple of the points in the case.
I think that adequate.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And there certainly seems to be enough proof to fix it.
This is a four briefcase case, at least.
May it please the court. I want to talk briefly about this remittiture business because it seems to me we're saying one thing on one side of the mouth and another out of the other. And I want to define that. They tell the court that when a court of appeals makes a decision that a verdict is excessive and says we will affirm this case on condition you file that remittiture, that if you file it without any effort to indicate you're not happy or whatever, even though you file it unconditionally and the court accepts it unconditionally, and did in this case, that you have waived any right to contend before this court that an erroneous rule of law was applied. Now,
have Roses indicated on the record in this case an intention to accept the remittiture in the event that this court finds that the appropriate standard was applied in the Court of Appeals?
Well, certainly we have, Your Honor, not only by the filing, but by, I told you a while ago about the INPEPCO, we wanted even, if we got some other way to preserve it. But your problem...
So that I'll be clear, the Roses have indicated that they'd rather have the remittiture than a new trial.
Absolutely. Although we don't want it to lose it. But I want to say this court, in dealing with the fact unfinding powers under our Constitution of the Courts of Appeals, have extended the rule that it's had for 100 years applicable to ordinary fact findings in Carson versus Cactus and these recent cases, Sosa, that the test for determining whether a court has properly exercised its unfinding power, which is what this is for excessiveness, is a determination by that court under the right standards so that we can determine whether they apply them correctly or not. Now that is, if I don't misread Larson versus Cactus Drilling, that you've applied the same principle of determining whether there's sufficiency on excessiveness of verdicts as on any other finding. And you have fought a lot of briefs and conversation in the public about the wrong of the courts don't have power, intermediate courts, to substitute their judgment, and this court is going to police whether proper standards were applied. If what they tell this court here is so, the affected party, even though a wrong standard is applied, hadn't got any standing before this court, whether he files or can file a motion for rehearing or not. Because if he files that remittiture unconditionally, that's the boat has sailed out.
I take it then it is also your position that this court could remand the case to the Court of Appeals for redetermination on what remittiture is appropriate.
That is correct, and I also had this to say, that you may disagree with us that the Court of Appeals applied an incorrect standard. That is, when you read, in which event, that aspect, the cut, stands to limit it.
If I think that they applied an incorrect standard,
then
I can send it back, you say, for the Court of Appeals to reevaluate the remittiture and suggest a smaller remittiture than they did previously.
Or should, and not only should do it, that's exactly what you just did in Sosa versus City of Bald Springs. That's exactly what you did Larson versus Cactus Drilling and in Polk versus Moore.
I'll tell you what troubles me about that, Mr. Cronger. Doesn't that put the CA and the Court of Appeals and the parties even more in the posture of negotiating the case?
And so you noted in your opinions. And
you're going to be back in Dallas saying, well, would you take $800,000 again?
But they don't give you that option when they're cutting verdicts. They don't say, hey, fella, you want to take that? It's not a negotiation in that sense.
Just discuss it at oral argument and come up with a number.
Well, I've never had one do that, and I've been there a number of times, but theoretically, that's a part of the ADR developing things in the Courts of Appeals.
Well, that's carrying it a step further.
But I just say what we would be doing would be undermining your proper opinions and all of the opinions in which you have carefully developed that the Constitution does not permit the substitution of the judgment of the intermediate court. And when they do take some action on a sufficiency question, where it deals with excessiveness, they should spell it out. And so that you can determine whether they did and apply the correct standard. Now, these observations you made, Judge, have been made in two or three of these recent opinions, often, and all of them concerning, well, aren't we just not returning the power to determine correctness into our own fact-finding power? And I am certainly not suggesting that here today. We're suggesting the court didn't apply Sosa and the principles of Sosa in any way. That you have in the past entertained similar motions. I say when we don't complain in some way in our motion for a rehearing that this is about the action not involving a proper legal standard, we waived it. We can't then come in any different than we did. What's the difference between telling the court that we still want to preserve our right to do it remittiture itself, or putting it in the motion for new trial? It's either or vital. But if the court does that, I think it's really a retreat backwards from all of the decisions in the last 5 years over how you can deal with the fact-finding powers of the intermediate courts. I do want to comment on the protection, the equal protection clause, because that's been raised. Let me go back to square one. The legislature did not undertake to make a distinction between death and injury cases. It treated them as one and the same for purposes of the principles of why this bill should be passed in the first place. They enumerated some 30 or 35 reasons, including death reasons. To assume the legislature would have enacted a law that did not, that dealt only with injury but not death, is, in my opinion, just a ludicrous speculation. To assume the Fifth Circuit would not have struck that down as equal protection, I just think would be incredible. You're not bound by the Fifth Circuit in determining constitutional guarantees.
Hey, are you saying the legislature could not make a rational distinction between injury and death cases for treatment?
I am saying that the legislature has first got to be determined that it would have made such a distinction. You can't just cut their act up and then assume the rest of it stays. If they had made that...
You're going to send us a supplemental brief,
wouldn't you? Not on this. I mean,
we're
we've done...
send us a brief.
The only thing I thought we were relating to
is... Oh, yeah, you did give us the site. I thought you were going to say a word or two about Ex parte Hensley. And
yeah.
If you were, you weren't. I'd be interested in some thoughts about savings clauses and about kind of standard or what...
The rule there is kind of like contracts, Judge, as you know, that if the act would have remained, if the legislature would have continued to follow your distinction and would have done that, if you strike a part of it, then you can assume the balance of it, because every piece of major legislation has a separability clause. But what I am saying to you, to attribute that to the legislature, when in its listing of the reasons for the enactment of the law in its entirety, is just beyond whatever they felt back in 1977 may not be the same thing they feel now. But that's what they declared it to do. Let me go further and tell you that on the question of what the Constitution did adopt, the common law, there was no cause of action for wrongful deaths. In fact, England, for whatever the reason, until they got Lord Campbell's Act, prohibited the action. The Constitution of 1876, and I know it's Washington Court to read something, but I'm going to read this provision. All laws and parts of law now in force. The wrongful death action was now in force.
And I understand your argument on the Constitution and the legislature's power. It would be probably constitutional for the legislature to outlaw criminal conversation, as they did 3 or 4 years ago, because it was outlawed completely. But if and when we ever get the case that limits a landowner's liability when the landowner opens up his or her land for public recreational uses, and I believe that was a limitation and not a total exculpation. That's probably a common law action. Never mind. I'm trying to think of statutory cause of that. You're saying any time the legislature seeks to quibble on a statutory cause of action that existed before 1876, they've got a serious constitutional impediment. But if they just want to abolish it completely, no problem.
They can't distinguish between the types of causes of action. They can't take injury and death and separate them any more than in the Tort Claims Act, which didn't have death in the caption, and it was attacked as not having, and you all say, yeah, but that means death too. You can't attribute constitutionally to the legislature differentiations they never would have made, or that you don't know they would have made.
Well, I'm off of that question now. I thought you were back to Article 3, Section 48.
Article 16, Section 48.
Yeah, right.
They're saying all laws are the laws of Texas.
And I believe I heard you say the legislature could completely abolish statutory cause of action if they wanted to.
Or a common law cause of action.
Yes, and they could abolish the Lord Campbell's Act to that.
They could go in and eliminate the Death Act.
But you're saying they cannot cap or quibble on it.
I'm saying they can't distinguish between people in the same situation. They can't, or comparable situations. Now that's equal protection more than Article 1.
Well, that's what I'm getting. I'm wondering, it sounds to me like you are arguing that we decided Lucas wrongly.
No, I'm not suggesting that, Your Honor. I think the open court...
You're saying if he just hurt, you put a cap on that, it has to be the same as the cap that you put on wrongful death.
No, you're not saying...
And let me give the death, the other side, this credit. There are differences between how you go about measuring your damages, Sanchez way, and wrongful death cases, and injury cases on the other hand. You've got the difference between measuring the value of human life in the future, where the guy's still alive, and then where he's not alive. But those are distinctions on how many angels can stand on a pinpoint. The cause of action is for just as you said when you said the Tort Claims Act included death, even though not named in the caption. They are so inexorably bound together that when you say one is invalid and the legislature is invalid, you can't separate out and leave the other alive. And that's apart from the waiver question, too. They never raised this question for Your Honor, and this court did in 1988. This whole question, the act can be distinguished on these grounds. And constitutional attack questions, as you know, are not to be originated in this court. But I don't want to retreat to that, Judge Phillips, and the rest of you, members of this tribunal. I want to say that it is wrong to let special interest legislation deny the most affected people their access to the courts for full relief. And it's really no larger nor smaller than that, and that's the sense of Lucas and the sense of what you told the Fifth Circuit. And I imagine that they would be quite amazed to learn that this court only was striking the statute down as it applied to injury cases. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, Counselor. That concludes the argument of the first cause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
Yeah, I am.